You're listening to Locally Sourced Science, your connection to the scientific discoveries happening in the Finger Lakes community.
Those delightful sounds are what I hear every day whenever a small child, elderly person, or man in a hat walks by my house on the sidewalk. I'm Patricia Waldron, your host for today's episode of Locally Sourced Science, and those are my dogs, Nova and Leo. For our last episode on dogs, we did so much interesting reporting that we decided to do a sequel. Today's episode will focus on canine genetic research and what that means for the breeding and health of our furry friends. In this episode, Liz Mahood speaks with Dr. Rory Todhunter from the Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine. Todhunter investigates canine hip dysplasia and other heritable bone diseases in dogs. Later on, Esther Akusin talks with Dr. Adam Boyko, also at the College of Veterinary Medicine, about his work using genetic data from thousands of dogs to understand how humans have selected specific traits in different breeds, and how genetics factor into certain canine diseases. Today's episode will also feature This Week in Science History with Candace Limper and a calendar of science events in the Finger Lakes area by Luisa Torres. So, without further ado, here is Liz Mahood with Dr. Rory Todhunter.
Dr. Todhunter has been researching the genetics underlying canine orthopedic diseases for decades. Along the way, he has made several important discoveries about canine osteoarthritis and hip dysplasia, including how these diseases are inherited and how they can be better spotted by veterinarians. Dr. Todhunter's lab is in Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Todhunter is the Maurice R. and Corian P. Greenberg Professor of Surgery in the Section of Small Animal Surgery. I sat down with Dr. Todhunter last week to discuss his research, particularly on inheritance of genetic diseases. Dr. Todhunter has found that canine hip dysplasia is a disease that is partially, but not completely, controlled by a dog's genes. This makes canine hip dysplasia relatively difficult to study, since if a disease is completely controlled by genes, then these genes are essential for the disease to develop. They will always be present in affected dogs, and thus they will be relatively easy to detect. Canine hip dysplasia is a bit different, as it is only partially controlled by genes, and each gene contributing to the development of the disease only does so slightly. Thus, canine hip dysplasia is what's known as a complex trait. The study of these traits involves several common experiments, which Dr. Todhunter will mention in the interview. An important one is the genome-wide screen, in which many organisms of the same species all get their genome sequenced. This allows researchers to associate diseases to genetic markers. For example, if all dogs with canine hip dysplasia have the same bits of DNA that are missing in dogs without hip dysplasia, then those DNA sequences may be contributing to the development of the disease. Keep this in mind throughout the interview. Hello, listeners. My name is Liz Mahood. Thank you for joining us today. With me is my guest, Dr. Rory Todhunter. And Dr. Todhunter, my first question is, how did you become interested in researching the genetics underlying canine traits and diseases?
Well, when I was a graduate student in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the Baker Institute, which is part of the college up on Snyder Hill, the lab that I worked in was a cartilage biochemistry laboratory, studied osteoarthritis or degenerative joint disease in dogs. And they, in that environment, they had a colony of dogs that naturally developed hip dysplasia, which they used to study the secondary effects of hip dysplasia, which was arthritis. So after I graduated and from Baker Institute, my graduate degree, I started work in the Small Animal Hospital, Cornell, where we see all of these conditions, including hip dysplasia, on a day-to-day basis in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So that just was an obvious transition into hip dysplasia and then other orthopedic traits which are commonly observed by and treated by orthopedic surgeons, which is what I do.
Yeah, I see. Cool. So you've mentioned canine hip dysplasia, and this is one of your lab's primary research interests. Can you explain a bit about what that is?
Yes, so dysplasia means malformation, and this is malformation of the hip, and you can get malformation in many other joints. And in the hip joint, basically it means that the femoral head, which is the ball part of the joint, and the socket, which is called the acetabulum, don't fit together properly. They're loose. And as the dogs grow, this laxity makes the cartilage and the joint move abnormally. That erodes the tissues and they get inflammation and arthritis in the joints. Very similarly to hip dysplasia in children. So dogs express the trait during growth. Children are examined at birth. And if they're dysplastic, they're treated depending on the severity. And dogs, we do similar types of treatment, but it's a little bit more delayed than you might do in a child at birth.
I see, yeah. So this is a trait that is present in the dog since the very beginning, since they're born.
Yes, it's inherited. It's congenital in that sense, but the physical expression of the trait, as far as we know, isn't really severe enough to detect clinically till the dogs are growing and walking around.
I see, yeah. Because then you wouldn't observe it before then, right? You wouldn't know that the dog has hip dysplasia.
No, and we don't have, so the only way you could do that is with genetic prediction capability, which several labs around the world, including ours, is working on. And there are two ways to go there, which is finding the mutations or the genes that contribute to the trait, which, because it's an inherited trait, they must be there. Or you can do a genome-wide screen and predict, just based on genetic markers, what the susceptibility is. But otherwise, you're relying on physical and imaging capability. And although people have worked on puppies using ultrasound, it hasn't been as successful as diagnosing the condition in children when they're born very early on.
I see. So could you say how much hip dysplasia is induced by genetics versus by other factors, such as a dog's diet, lack of exercise?
Yes, most complex traits, orthopedic complex traits, including hip dysplasia, are called complex because they have multiple genes contributing to the condition, which have to be expressed in the tissue of interest. And then there's some sort of environmental regulation. So for hip dysplasia, about a third of the variation in what we can appreciate radiographically or clinically is explained by the underlying genetic composition of the dog, which can be calculated on a pedigree basis, or you can also do it using genome-wide methods.
Okay.
So that other two-thirds is environment or non-genetic factors. And the only one that's really been there are two that have been really well studied. One is growth rate, which is controlled by the plane of nutrition. So if you maximize nutritional plane and maximize growth, you maximize genetic expression.
So does that maximize the chance that the dog will get dysplasia?
And if you restrict growth to keep the dog slim, you can reduce the expression of the trait and the secondary arthritis. And there's one drug that's been shown to modulate the genetic expression, which is used in the racehorse industry, and it can be used in dogs, which is used basically for treating arthritis. It's called Adequan. If you inject puppies with that product from birth or from weaning to maturity, you can restrict expression of the trait.
I see. So this drug, does it influence the nutrition of the dog, or does it actually influence how these genes that cause hip dysplasia are being expressed?
We don't really know.
Okay.
We do know that it is a drug that's been around for a long time in human medicine, which transitioned to veterinary medicine, and it's used to treat and prevent the secondary arthritis. It acts on chemicals that degrade the joint, especially the articular cartilage, and inhibits those factors. So that's one way that it probably affects the arthritis, but we don't know why it could possibly modulate the true inherited phenotype, which is the hip dysplasia. So there are two things we're looking at. One is the inherited trait, which is the hip dysplasia, which you may be able to control by good breeding practices. And the secondary effects which is the arthritis, which probably is also has a genetic component too, but we don't know a lot about that secondary genetic effect.
I see. Are purebred dogs more susceptible to developing hip dysplasia? And are there other breeds of dogs that are more susceptible than others?
Yes. They all dogs get hip dysplasia. But if you look at purebred dogs and look at the rankings in the registries where that information is available, like the Orthopedic Foundation for Animals, which has been running in the United States since the 1960s, you can search in that website, mm-hmm. ofa.org, and you can rank the most susceptible to the least susceptible breeds.
Yeah. Do you know why purebred dogs might be more susceptible to this, or why some breeds are more susceptible than others?
The way we've bred them. So modern dog breeds have been around for a couple of centuries. So if you go back to the ancient breeds, they also get hip dysplasia, including the wolf. And of course, domestic dogs derive from the wolf about, depends on who you believe, 12 to 20,000 years ago. And wolves get hip dysplasia too, and that's known from necropsy studies. Mm. So somehow the way we've designed these breeds, picking 3 or 4 or 5 individual dogs to produce a particular type of dog, and clinically the giant, large breed, medium-sized dogs are more susceptible clinically, although small breeds mm-hmm. do get hip dysplasia.
Mm-hmm.
We've looked for particular features of these dogs, and when we bred for these features, we've dragged along these deleterious mutations, which when you line breed, which you have to do to produce a pure breed, and when you do that line breeding, you concentrate the deleterious alleles unknowingly often, and then when they are all combined together in these offspring, in a proportion of these dogs, you'll express the trait. And that happens more commonly in some breeds than others. So a resistant breed would be dogs that are bred for essentially high athletic activity. Greyhounds, Borzois, Salukis,
yeah.
Whippets.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So how does the genetic work that you do on hip dysplasia affect breeding programs?
So if you look across the world, including in our group, there are two ways to try and control, well, there are several ways to control the incidence of the, or frequency of the problem. One is to use pedigree information, which people have been doing for a long, long time. That works to a certain extent, but by eyeballing essentially a pedigree and selecting dogs based on their phenotype and their relatives.
Mm-hmm.
The better way to do it is what an agricultural practitioner would do for cattle breeding, pig breeding, sheep breeding, plant breeding, which would be to use a breeding or estimated breeding value, which several groups around the world provide to dog breeders, including at Cornell. So you can search for breeding values, hip and elbow breeding values for dogs on the Cornell website. And when you find a dog with, so basically you can rank them for their genetic quality essentially, and the idea would be that you breed in the better half of the breeding pool based on their breeding value, which is derived from the pedigree information and the radiographic information of the hips. The other way to do it would be with genomic information, which people are working on quite productively at the moment. So you would predict the phenotype or the genetic quality based on the genomic information, which is a group of genetic markers spread across the genome. The best way to do it probably is to find the mutations, but that's very hard to do for most of these complex multigenic traits where you have many genes contributing generally in a small way to the final phenotype, which is the radiographic appearance of the hip.
I see, yeah. And even if you did find all of these traits, like you said, it only contributes about a third.
A third, but it doesn't really matter, because if you don't have the mutations and enough of them, you won't get hip dysplasia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you need to have enough. No one knows how many. My work suggests maybe 5 to 10. Mutations that have to be present. And the other thing to remember is there's no such thing probably as a perfect hip. It's everything from the best hips to the worst hips, and a lot of dogs fall in the middle.
I see.
Dogs with the best hip conformation, like a greyhound or a borzoi, have very deep cups or acetabuli where the femoral heads fit in perfectly. And there are other dogs which are right on the other end, which are called luxoid hips, where they never make contact. But most dogs are in the middle. And the clinical expression of the problem, which is the arthritis, can't be judged by the radiograph, mm-hmm. which makes clinical work difficult, because then you're basing everything on your clinical examination and the owner's history and response to therapy. So it's a tricky condition to deal with. And no matter how much you remove dysplastic dogs from the breeding programs and breed only the dogs with the best hip conformation, you're never going to get rid of the problem, because some of the dogs with the best hips still carry some of the mutations. And if you can breed that dog to another dog carrying a complementary group of mutations, you're going to get offspring. And it's a rough affected offspring. It's a rough idea. If you breed enough unaffected animals, you'll get about a third affected offspring. If you breed enough affected animals, you'll get about a third unaffected offspring. But you have to breed many litters to be able to determine that. That's the problem with eyeballing a pedigree and trying to pick winners and losers. It's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us today. And again, this was Dr. Rory Todd-Hunter. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locally Sourced Science. In today's episode, we're talking with experts in canine genetic research.
I'm Esther Rakusin for Locally Sourced Science. Last week, I met an adorable cream-colored terrier-like dog with very short legs. Looking at the mutt, I asked her owner, "Is she part corgi?" The dog owner replied that she really had no idea. It turns out that these days, humans can learn more about their pup's family tree. They can take a skin sample from their dog's cheek and send it in for DNA analysis. To learn more about dog genome analysis, I spoke to Dr. Adam Boyko, Associate Professor in the Department of Biomedical Sciences at the Cornell College of Veterinary Medicine. He studies canine evolution and genetics and is the founder and Chief Science Officer of Embark Veterinary, a canine genetic testing company. Humans have bred dogs to have certain characteristics. I asked Adam Boyko how this selective breeding has helped dog geneticists with DNA analysis.
You can have really strong selection for certain traits in dogs, probably stronger than what most natural populations go through. And so you can very quickly identify a trait and fix it in a population. This is what dog breeders have been doing. And so it makes it useful as a geneticist, because you have these really extreme signatures in the genome where the genetic variation is patterned completely differently because there's been this response to selection. And in fact, many of the traits in dogs that we've been able to identify the genetic basis for, it was first because we were looking at genomes and we saw these patterns indicative of positive selection. And then we went back and tried to figure out, well, what trait could have possibly driven this? And make discoveries that way.
Boyko was one of the authors on a paper called "Population Variation Revealed High Altitude Adaptation of Tibetan Mastiffs." I asked him what the researchers found out about the genome of this selectively bred dog.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because the Tibetan Mastiff and the other high altitude adapted dogs there on the Tibetan Plateau showed a signature of selection in this EPAS1 gene, which is in the HIF pathway. So this is the pathway for hypoxia adaptation. And it's the same gene that actually causes altitude adaptation in human Tibetans. So you have this parallel evolution that's gone on. The same gene has adapted in both dogs and people as they adapted to a similar high-altitude environment.
I then asked, what is the extent of similarity between the dog and human genomes?
It depends how you calculate similarity, but if you're talking about the, you know, protein coding genes in the genome, you're looking at about 85% similarity. You can actually line up more of the dog genome to the human genome than you can line up the mouse genome to the human genome. And so that makes dogs, it's one of the reasons why dogs are good for geneticists to study, because it's more likely if you find something in dogs that there's going to be an analogous genomic region in humans, and the phenotypes tend to be more similar because dogs are more similar in body size and longevity and environment than rodents are to humans.
Boyko talked about why he started the company Embark Veterinary and how the DNA information is used.
Yeah, so the start of this company, you know, came directly out of the research, you know, my lab was doing at Cornell, and we were interested in finding the genetic basis of all sorts of characteristics and diseases in dogs. And we're kind of a big data lab, and we got grant funding, and we looked at, you know, 5,000 dogs, and we identified genes involved in fur shedding and you know, genetic predispositions for different stuff. But it became clear that many of the traits we were really interested in, like behavior, cancer, and hip dysplasia, 5,000 samples was a drop in the bucket. We really needed, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 100 times more data than that, because we're looking at complicated genetic conditions where each gene only explains a portion of the risk, and therefore you need large sample sizes in order to disentangle it, which is what we knew from human genetic research. So it wasn't a big surprise, but it was sort of a, how do we get this much data?
He then described how his company analyzes the dog DNA.
So we analyze it the same way we analyze samples in my lab. So we use, you know, we extract the DNA, we use a genotyping array where we've got markers all across the genome, including at specific locations that we know are important for certain traits and diseases. And then we take that genetic information, we run it through this bioinformatics pipeline that, you know, calculates inbreeding, calculates the relatives of the dog if they have already been tested with us, so you know who your dog's, you know, relatives are, which can be interesting for many dogs. My dog found a long-lost cousin that we didn't know about that actually lives, you know, just a few miles from where we are, so that was kind of neat. And then also does ancestry deconvolution, which breeds are in your dog, you know, looks at maternal and paternal lineages, comes up with a prediction of what the adult body weight for your dog should be, you know, what coat color loci are. Over 170 genetic health conditions are tested and dozens of traits.
Dr. Adam Boyko's company has now analyzed DNA samples from hundreds of thousands of dogs. I asked him, how do his human customers feel about submitting samples from their dogs for the benefit of science? What kind of feedback does he get?
Almost without exception, extremely excited. Every time there's a new research discovery and we write them and we update their dog's profile, they're like, oh, it's so great that, you know, we took your test and, you know, and the fact that they can contribute to the research. So, you know, we've sent out emails before, hey, you know, we're studying this. Your dog looks really interesting. Can you answer this two-question survey so we can include them in the study? And people are very enthusiastic, you know, to do that and want to know what the results are.
Well, and the dogs wag their tails, of course.
Yes, yes.
So now we have another reason to thank dogs, not just for their unconditional love and companionship, but also for their significant contributions to science. For Locally Sourced Science, I'm Esther Rakusin.
Hi, everybody. My name is Candace Limper, and I am with Locally Sourced Science, and I am providing the science history for this week. Have you ever wondered when and where dogs originated? Our companion dogs are said to have emerged from an extinct wolf species some 15,000 to 40,000 years ago. However, where dogs were domesticated is heavily debated, and this could be due to this occurring in different places at one time. A lot of this information has been extracted from looking at canine genetics, but also from doing selection experiments. A fascinating study I read about was when researchers were trying to determine how characteristics of wild dogs differ from the domesticated dog. To answer this question, they domesticated kit foxes, which is a wild fox species of North America. In this experiment, there were two groups of foxes, one that was selectively bred for their friendliness for 45 years, known as the experimental domestication, and the other group to be compared was a fox kit group where friendliness was not being selected for. In the process of behavioral selection, there are physical characteristics such as floppy ears, shortened
or curled tails, and hair depigmentations that were also selected. This suggests that domestication traits are associated with physical characteristics that we see in dogs today. More recently, scientists have identified genes associated with hypersocial personalities, which are also implicated in human genes. Dogs and humans have been known to share similar genes or their lack of and have similar phenotypes. The absence of a particular gene that I found to be of interest is involved in humans, which is known as Williams syndrome, a genetic disorder which can result in unusual friendliness. Where in humans, a chunk of genes is missing, in contrast to dogs, the more genetic disruption in these genes, the more sociable the dog. However, genetic similarities between dogs and humans shouldn't be a surprise after knowing that we share about 84% of the same genes. Given that we share so many genes with dogs, we have been able to use dogs as a model to find drugs to help alleviate symptoms in retinal disease, lymphoma, epilepsy, and allergies. And in some cases, the dogs have been proven to be a superior model compared to that of the mouse. More recently, dogs have been shown to have more comparable microbiome to humans relative to that of pigs and mice. This may have something to do with dogs being in the same environment as that of their companions. The domestication of dogs from an extinct wolf species some 20,000 years ago has resulted in many mutually beneficial traits, from companionship to better understanding diseases. My name is Candace Limper with Locally Sourced Science, and that was your science history.
You're listening to Locally Sourced Science. This is your science calendar. From Monday, May 24th to Monday, June 3rd, visit the exhibit called And Turned Leaves, Early Women in Botanical Illustration at the Mann Library at Cornell. The exhibit will showcase the achievements of several pre-20th century women who drew and painted plants and fungi for the botanical text of the 18th and 19th centuries. The Mann Library has developed this exhibit for 2019 Women's History Month. The exhibit is open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. From Monday, May 27th through Friday, May 31st, at the Nevin Welcome Center at Cornell Botanic Gardens, visit the art exhibit Traces by Emma Olin Cleese. This exhibit represents the beginning of an ongoing project which catalogs vulnerable plants in the state of New York. Seven species displayed represent a small percentage of plants that are either locally extinct or considered endangered. From Tuesday, May 28th to Friday, June 7th, at the Mann Gallery of the Cornell Mann Library, visit the exhibit called Pollination, Artists and Scientists Crossing Borders to Explore the Value of Pollinator Health. This exhibit showcases the results of a multi-year collaboration between entomology professor Scott McCart and Welsh artists who crossed national and disciplinary boundaries to celebrate the beauty and importance of pollinators and reveal how their fate is linked to our planet and to our own. This project has brought artists and scientists together on two continents to explore and promote the worldwide crisis facing pollinators. The exhibit is open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Science on Tap is this Wednesday, May 29th at 7 p.m. at Casita del Polaris, 1201 North Cayuga Street. Learn about how scientists are using ancient light to illuminate giant clusters of galaxies and probe the mass of one of nature's most abundant but elusive particles, from Eve Babajakis, PhD candidate in physics. Then, learn how researchers are tracking volcanic behavior with satellite sensors to predict eruptions and provide early warnings, from Dr. Kevin Reith, PhD in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. On Sunday, June 2nd, at 1 p.m. at the Cayuga Nature Center, learn about changes in plant life on timescales from paleo to present, from research scientist Liz Hermsen and educator Ingrid Sabel, during a walk along the Cayuga Nature Center's Tree Phenology Trail. This event is part of our Climate Smart Stewardship Series. I'm Luisa Torres, and that was your science calendar.
Thanks for joining us this week for Locally Sourced Science. If you have a science question or an idea for a future show, you can contact us on Twitter at FLX Science Radio, on Facebook at Locally Sourced Science, and on Instagram at locally.sourced.science. Today's show featured interviews by Esther Rakusin and Liz Mahood, and contributions from Candace Limper and Luisa Torres. The show was produced by me, Patricia Waldron. This episode also included music and vocal performances from Joe Lewis, Che Che Giannotti, Blue Dot Sessions, and my dogs, Leo and Nova. Locally Sourced Science is produced at WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.